Hello, I'm Mark DeLuzio. Over the past century, our constitutional republic, grounded in the rule of law, has been transformed into a tyrannical democracy, orchestrated by unelected bureaucrats and globalists. The Constitution is now treated as a suggestion, not the law of the land. Welcome to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God.
Hi, I'm Mark's co-host, Suzette Lawrence. Our intention is to explore the Constitution and discuss how our freedoms and constitutional rights are violated by those very politicians who took an oath on the Bible to uphold it. Learn how the Constitution is the solution to our country's problems. What do we need to do to restore our inalienable and enumerated rights? Class begins now.
Welcome to episode 34, Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence. Suzette, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mark. I'm really excited about what you're going to be talking about today, what we're going to be talking about today. I mean,
I forgot what we're talking about. What are we talking about? I have no idea.
We're talking about how Congress violates the Constitution with all of their spending and their workarounds for spending. Especially yep. on things like war, which are, just devastating. It's not like they never do that when it comes to something like that would benefit us,
we decided to name this episode, Suzette, the checks and balances are unchecked and unbalanced.
No question.
Okay, and the subtitle here is how our government intentionally violates the checks and balances of the U.S. Constitution. So I want to go back on, I had it down here somewhere. The episodes 3 and 12 of our podcast, if you want to go back and get more in depth about the checks and balances, one of the things that Anton Scalia said, which I think he was an incredible jurist, God rest his soul, and it's very just suspicious how he died, but he was a true originalist. And an originalist means, hey, he's going to interpret the Constitution as it was intended to be interpreted based on the founding fathers. And so you look at documents like the Federalist Papers and all the other writings that have gone around to explain really what is the Constitution, what was the real intent and meaning of it back then, and the 1828 dictionary, which I just gave you for a birthday present. Oh, there it is. Okay. Well, that's the Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. I sent you that one too. There you go. That dictionary was created, and I think we had an episode on this where Webster put this dictionary together without the internet. I can't believe how many words are in there. It's an incredible document. But his whole intent of that dictionary was to memorialize the words that were used at that time in that era, even though it was written in 1828 or published in 1828. He wanted to document the words so that, we know what they meant, like bear arms in the Second Amendment. Bear means handheld. Okay. See, the words have changed meanings over the course of time. Words like war. Well, what does war really mean? When people say, well, we're not really at war in Yemen right now. We're not really at war in Iraq. Really? Look up his dictionary. Look up the definition of war. I think you're going to find that we're at war. Okay. That's what that dictionary is about. But, the Constitution, and again, we named this the Constitution Solution simply because if we really believe, if we follow the Constitution, which everybody takes an oath by when they take office, whether you're a state legislator or a federal official, most of our problems would go away if we followed it. But this episode is talking about how our government, our Congress, our courts have allowed the other branches of government. So you got the checks and balances between the three parts of our government. You've got the executive branch, which is the president. You've got the legislative, which is the Congress and Senate. They write laws. And you got the judicial, which is the Supreme Court, which decides constitutionality. And they have other duties as well. But between all those three branches, we have checks and balances. And Anton Scalia, going back to him, indicated that that perhaps is the most brilliant part of what the founders did, how they crafted our form of government. Okay. And so it's the checks and balances. And there are many other unbelievable things that they did. Things like the Second Amendment, things like the Electoral College, things that the fact that we're a republic and not a democracy. We talked about all those things. But the checks and balances is a real key here. Now, I want to go back a little bit of history, Suzette. In the Declaration of Independence, the Lord is mentioned four times. Three of those times, he's mentioned as the executor. He's mentioned as the judge, the judicial branch. And he's mentioned as the legislator, if you will. So he can, and he's probably, he is the only person who can effectively perform all three branches of our government in one individual. Well, the founders knew that no one man or woman, well, at the time, unfortunately, it was only man, but no one man could effectively be all three of those. So they split up the branches of government into those three. And it comes right out of the Declaration, really. So when people say, well, you know, there's no, you know, Christian tie to the Constitution, they didn't put God in the Constitution for a reason, because the government's owned by the people, okay? And they didn't want religion out, so.
And also, for a lot of people that don't believe in God, Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior, they often like discount it. But here's the deal. Whether you're a believer or not, you're still protected by it.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, and the interesting thing, I think 96.
We'll take care of you. Don't worry. We'll make sure. We're doing our best to resurrect the Constitution.
I think 95 or 96% of the population back when these documents were written were Christians at the time.
They were.
And so it's a pretty heavy deal. But the checks and balances is so very important as to making sure our government operates the way it's intended to operate. But I want to go through, Suzette, four or five, maybe six, I don't know how many I have here, things that we've done legislatively, either that or through the courts, that basically have allowed our government to circumvent these checks and balances. Okay. And by the way, let me give you one example of a check and balance. The right for the Congress to impeach the president is a check and balance. The right for the president to veto a law is part of the checks and balances. The right for the Supreme Court to declare a law unconstitutional or an executive order unconstitutional is a check and balance against either the Congress or the executive branch, the president, right? So we have all these various checks and balances. Now, that's just a few of them that I just mentioned. Well, okay, so let's start looking at all the different things that happened here. And I'm going to start with probably the one that's near and dear to my heart, and that's the ability for the president to declare war. Article 1, Section 8 indicates that Congress declares war. Now, by the way, declaring war and going to war are two different things. The Congress can declare war. The president doesn't have to go to war. He is the commander-in-chief. He does not have to put the military in harm's way, even if the Congress does declare war, okay? And again, that's a check and balance because he is the commander-in-chief, okay? So he controls the military. But the founders did not want any one person to unilaterally have the ability to declare war. They want that to be the responsibility of Congress, okay, the U.S. House of Representatives. And that's Article 1, Section 8, which, by the way, Article 1, Section 8, we're going to come back to that quite a bit during this conversation, and we'll talk about that more. Well, in 1973, we wrote the War Powers Resolution requiring the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of committing armed forces to military action and forbids armed forces for a remaining more than 60 days with a further 30-day withdrawal period without congressional authorization for use of the military, okay? Or a declaration of war by the Congress. So this War Powers Resolution in 1973 happened at the aftermath of the Vietnam War. We just got out of Vietnam. Nixon pulled us out. And it was vetoed by Nixon. He did not like this provision. I believe on constitutional grounds, and it was overridden by the Congress. Okay, you need a two-thirds vote to override it, and they overrode it. So we have this War Powers Resolution now that gives the president the power to engage our military without a declaration of war. Right there, that's wired into our legal framework. And I happen to think the War Powers Resolution of 1973 is just unconstitutional. If you really look at the, you know, the Article 1, Section 8 requirements that say Congress can only declare war.
Why do you think they did it? Why do you think they betrayed us in that way? Gave up their power.
I think there's a lot of ill aftermath, if you will, ill effects of being in Vietnam, with all the deaths, 58,000 deaths, all the protests, everything else. So I think that had something to do with it. Okay, but deep down inside, I always think there's a bigger reason, Suzette. Because that's so. That's a really good question that you're asking. I think down below, you start looking at, you know, why would they do this? Why would Congress give up their control? Got to believe there's some nefarious reasons as to why, and which all has to do with going back to what you and I've talked about with globalism and Marxism and all that. I really do. So why would you as a congressman want to give that power up?
Yeah.
You represent the people, right?
Right. And if you, it doesn't make sense to me that they would do that. It also doesn't, if we were in imminent danger, I can see where, and I guess that's what this War Powers Resolution was about, was like, you know, that the president could make these decisions without Congress, but it was limited to 60 days. Now, my question is, my question is this, the, if we're going to war, usually, I mean, were we worried about a surprise attack at that point? No.
No.
The nuclear missiles were removed from Turkey. Our nuclear warheads were removed from Turkey. The Soviet Union at the time had removed, didn't ever get theirs into Cuba, which was their plan. So we didn't have, you know, we weren't isolated. So we know what, we kind of knew what was going on in the world. It wasn't like we were going to get a surprise attack. At right. that time, we really did have a very, very powerful military. And we also had, and this is kind of sad to say, but we had a really battle-hardened military. You know, I mean, there's one thing to, you know, soldiers will tell you when they're willing to talk about it, that it really takes, you have to fight a war to actually be good at it. You don't learn that at West Point or the Air Force Academy or at the Naval Academy. You have to be in it, kind of in it to win it, if you will. So we had a battle-hardened military then. It doesn't make any sense to me that that kind of power would be forfeited to one guy.
Let's remember what was going on there. Okay, so first of all, Lyndon Johnson did go to Congress, but he lied about the Bay of Tonkin, that they attacked us and they didn't. And so he sold a bill of goods, which is one of the reasons why the suspicion is Kennedy was assassinated, along with RFK, because they Kennedy wanted to pull out of Vietnam. RFK did not want to be there at all. And Johnson profited greatly. He was a big shareholder in Bell Helicopter. So one of the reasons that we think that they're talking about now, you listen to Roger Stone and all that, and why he was assassinated, not only repercussions from the Bay of Pigs, from the CIA, all those people that got killed there. Kennedy was talked into evading, going after Castro by the CIA head Dulles at the time. He didn't want to do that. And he also did not want to be in Vietnam. So Johnson lied to the American people and to Congress to get us into Vietnam. If you look at Truman, he brought us shortly after World War II, he brought us into Korea, did not go to Congress, but he brought us in and he called it a police action. Okay. 37,000 body bags later, he called it a police action, right? So he didn't think he needed to go to Congress. And there were other presidents that did that. Now, Nixon himself went into Cambodia. And he wasn't supposed to go into, he had no authorization to go into Cambodia. We didn't even, I met a Cambodian veteran. He was selling hot dogs on the side of the road over here in Cave Creek, Arizona. And it said veteran, you know, hot dogs. So I said, I'm going to stop and talk to this guy, right? And I bought a couple hot dogs from him, right? And my wife's in the car. Like 30 minutes later, she's like, what are you doing talking to this guy? He was in Cambodia. And the first thing I said to him was, I said, so you didn't get your benefits, did you? He goes, how did you know that? Because you weren't supposed to be there. The military wiped your records clean, didn't they? He goes, wow, you're one of the few people I think that even know that. I go, yeah, well, did you get your benefits? I finally got them last year, he said. Now, this, now think about last year. Okay, 2023. It took him that long. He said, my Purple Heart.
That's like 50 years.
I didn't get my Purple Heart. I didn't get this. I didn't get that. No, I'm telling you, that's what's going on. So I think a lot of, yeah.
So let's slow this train down just for a second. So we have a president that makes a decision to go in to essentially have a secret war in Cambodia. Denies that it happens, and Laos, I think, too. Denies that this is going on. Because I remember, I am young enough, old enough, to remember that war, and I protested against it in Washington on multiple occasions, and never got in any trouble for it. You know, the president listened. He was Nixon was really worried because we were in the street on the lawn of the Washington Monument protesting peacefully that war. So he knew it was very unpopular. So what's he do? He goes covert. And do they make any kind of plan for all of these people that are going to go in and fight to take care of them? That's like so horrible. That in and of itself.
They do a lousy job, Suzette, with just the guys that are supposed to be where they're supposed to be. So, that answers your question a little bit, I think, in terms of why did they write that? They wanted to be able to pull. Now, I look at this War of Powers resolution of 73, and I say to myself, we don't need that. You want to know why? We have the Constitution. We don't need another law to tell us that the president can't. Now, this actually gives them more latitude than the Constitution. Okay. So, anyway, that's one example. I'll go on to some of the other examples, but. That's one example. And now you got Biden fighting all these wars without going to Congress. I asked Mike Johnson. I was about 15 feet from him at a meet and greet a couple months ago. I asked Scalise just 3 days ago. And they all talked around it. These guys are great about talking around it. And I let them know I was a Gold Star father. And, you know, these guys talk around it. I said, you know, I don't hear anything from Congress holding the president's feet to the fire in terms of taking our military to war without coming to you guys for approval. Okay. So anyway, that's one way our rights get abridged or stomped on, I should say. Let me talk about another one. Article 1, Section 8. Again, going back. Now, remember, Article 1, Section 8 is the enumerated powers of Congress, the 18 powers of Congress that they could write laws around. Okay, now I'm going to come back to that later when I talk about the General Warfare Clause. But I'm going to talk about the graduated income tax.
Oh, good.
In Article 1, Section 8, it basically says Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from, okay. Power to collect taxes, but the taxes have to be apportioned to the population of the states. So in other words, if the federal tax is $4,000, it will be $4,000 for Suzette and $4,000 for Mark DeLuzio. Despite the fact that Suzette makes $5 million a year and I only make $20 a year, okay? It's proportioned evenly amongst the states, okay? That was in the Constitution. Well, here comes the 16th Amendment, which says the power to lay and collect income taxes on income from whatever source derived, now this is the key, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration, which basically gave way to the graduated income tax. The more you make, the more you earn, or how I like to think about it, the more you make, the more you're penalized. And the graduated income tax, Suzette, is one of the 10 tenets of the Marxist Communist Manifesto. It's one of the 10. Look it up. It's one of the 10. You got the book there. Okay. The graduated income tax. Now, why did they do that? So everybody really, back in 1913, when the 16th Amendment was passed, most people wanted this 16th Amendment because the whole idea of the rich have to pay their fair share. These progressives today who think that that's a new saying, fair share, they've been using that back in 1913, almost like when Custer was a private, okay? And what they did is they convinced the American people that the rich are getting rich at the expense of them. That is exactly the Communist Manifesto, that whole notion that the rich aren't earning it, they're taking it from the working class, you know, and you got the proletariats, which are the working class, right? And the bourgeoisie, who is the pretty much the middle class, people who start small businesses, people who work, okay? They pitted employers. Those two groups. What's that?
People that employ other people.
People that employ businesses. You have a flower shop, okay? They're the bourgeois, if you will, that is taking from the lower class, the proletariats, right? So this whole business was, that whole mindset was put into the American people way back then, and most people wanted the 16th Amendment. Now people say, oh, you know, they have the power to collect taxes on their income, and that's not fair. And well, the way I read the Constitution, we had the right to do that way back in when the Constitution was ratified, that we could tax income. Matter of fact, we did in some respects. So it's that to me is not the issue with the 16th Amendment. The issue is they got rid of the apportionment clause, which now allows for a graduated income tax, which is one of the 10 tenets of the Marxist agenda. So there's another reason why, through legislation, in this case, it's an amendment, you know, invoked by our Article 5, that Wilson, your buddy Woody Wilson, signed into law, okay? And so here again is another chip off of our rights relative to the original Constitution.
It's just horrible. So when you're talking about apportionment, be it like, say, you have a state that's highly populated.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? So if you have a state that has a lot of people, that they would pay, they've still paid the same amount. It's just that more comes from that state. Wouldn't it be that, like, say you
said, that's right. That's right.
You know, so there's one, say the tax rate is 2%, and everybody pays 2% unless you're, say, disabled or elderly or something. You know, there are always going to be people that you would exclude from that. But if you're looking at just like an income tax, which I really hate, I don't like the name, I don't like the word income tax, because it suggests that I'm owned by someone and I have to pay them in order to work.
So yeah, it's exactly right. I think that's the right way to think about it. And yeah, just to go back on your question, let's say the state of Iowa had 8% of the nation's population, 8% of the taxes had to come from the people from Iowa. That's kind of what that means, okay? And the way I look at the income tax is this. The personal property, your right to personal property in the Constitution, okay? When I earn income, I own that income.
Right.
At least theoretically. Now you're taking it from me as a government, okay? That's infringing on my personal property rights, in my opinion, okay? Now, if I had a sales tax, Let's say it's the national sales tax. I'm going to decide and factor in whether or not I'm going to buy, you know, that computer or that car or whatever based on the tax. And it's me deciding to forego that money to the government when I make that purchase. That's a lot different than somebody taking it from you. Okay.
So if we had like a national sales tax where a portion of anything we purchased, except for food, because you have to buy food unless you grow your own. So a national sales tax at a certain rate, agreed upon rate, would apply to everyone.
Yep.
So you would naturally, depending on how much you're spending, be paying more or less. And so now
That's
the
right.
control of how much you're spending or how much you're taxed is in your court. The ball's just
Now,
in your court.
The low resolution argument would be, hey, if that guy's a billionaire, he should have to pay more. Why?
Why?
Why? Just like in a legal case, you cannot, and the Supreme Court did rule this way, that your ability to pay a judgment should not be factored into what that judgment would be. So like when they went and fined President Trump millions and millions and millions of dollars because he could pay it, that was just unconstitutionally wrong. And he'll win that case, okay? But you can't do that. So in other words, if you make, you know, $15 an hour at McDonald's, or if you're a billionaire, you should be charged with the same civil penalty, regardless of how much money you make. That's already been decided. So why is taxes this way? See, again, the whole idea with the Marxist agenda is to knock down the wealthy, the bourgeois, knock them down and bring them down to be even with all. And you have to remember what Thomas Jefferson said. The equal treatment of unequal people, there's nothing more unequal than the equal treatment of unequal people. And that's what Marx wanted. Okay. So anyway, that's another one, the graduated tax. Now, executive orders, another way that our constitutional rights are being infringed. Now, we did a whole episode, Suzette. What was that one? It was episode 13. So if you want to go back, and I won't spend a lot of time on executive orders, but we go through the executive orders and the infringements when Truman wanted to overtake through executive order. He wanted to take over the steel industry in this country. Well, the Supreme Court knocked that down. Okay. Teddy Roosevelt, all kinds of infringements. I'm sorry, FDR and Teddy as well. We went through all the infringements through executive orders when they're trying to write law through executive orders, which again, the checks and balances suggest that Congress writes law. Now, the president has the right through checks and balances to veto, and the Congress has the right to override the veto. Those are all checks and balances, okay? Now, when you actually look at the reference in the Constitution to executive orders, there is none. There is none. It does say the president has the right through the executive branch to enforce the law, okay? But that's it, okay? So these executive orders, and we go through the whole history of executive orders in episode 13. So if you want to learn more about that, go back to that, okay? But there's just another way where we're working around the Constitution.
The Constitution is so separate from the government at this point that I think about things like referendums, for instance, that everyone that runs for office has to pass a test, just like new citizens do. You know, if you want to become a citizen of the United States, you have to take a citizenship class. Now, most Americans don't understand, you know, they're not taught this in school anymore, and they're not inclined to learn it. They're not curious. You know, I got interested in it because I was just so curious about it. I wondered, you know, when I would see these things, you know, like that were just so wrong. And I thought, well, how is that possible? Where in the law does it say that? So it's, you know, that they can do this. Well, they're breaking the law, but you have to have a political will, a legal will not like when you die, Will, but like an energy to pursue these criminals, people that break the law, that profit from war, that profit, heck, from everything. You know, I was listening to a woman named Catherine Austin Fitz when she was the secretary of HUD, of housing, HUD, under Bush. And she came in there, and she was a financial person. She came in, the first thing she said as the director of this, as the secretary of HUD, was, we're going to audit everything we own because we have this huge budget. How many units do we own? Where do we own them? What do we own? Let's like get a grip on this. No one would do it. They immediately, the people that worked for her, immediately they had mutiny on the bounty, and she ended up in court for 10 years. And like President Trump, she was financially, could financially sustain 10 years of legal arguments. And she did win. But in the meantime, why didn't they want an audit? Because they were wasting money. She basically figured out for all the units we had and the budget that these should be luxury accommodations, not, you know, no water, no heat, holes in the ceiling, and rodent infested, which is what was the case in a lot of these cases. So it was very, you know, it's a very interesting position we find ourselves in, is that these megalomaniacs are really kind of drawn to public service. You know, they show up and they get rich.
Well, and, you know, I'm gonna jump to one of the last ones I was gonna talk about, because you just dovetailed right into what I wanted to talk about here. The unconstitutional branches of government, which HUD is one, okay, and these branches of government now, and I think we talked quite a bit about these branches. I think on episode 8, especially, we talked about the unconstitutional branches of government, where Congress passes broad laws, sets up these agencies, and then gives them a lot of discretion as to what regulations they write, which have the power of law. Now, those regulations, in a lot of sense, are dictated by the president. So you really now got the president writing law through these agencies via regulations. That's not how our country was supposed to be set up. And I still go back to the famous case with CDC, you know, your favorite agency, where they actually prohibited homeowners from evicting their tenants from not paying their rent during COVID. And these landlords lost their homes, okay? The CDC passed that regulation, okay? And this is the kind of power that we've given up. We don't have any representation anymore. I did an episode on that earlier on that said, you know, we're not a representative government anymore, because I can't call my congressman to complain about somebody in the CDC, because he has no play in that. I had a big IRS issue with some payments I was getting from India. I needed a document from the IRS so it wouldn't be taxed up the yin yang. And it was taking forever for them to get that. I called my congressman. They basically said, we don't have any play with the IRS. We can't affect them. We can't. They're going to put us in line just like they're putting you in line. Okay. So you're not represented anymore. These agencies, you know, and remember, Article 6, the laws have to be pursuant to be valid, okay? Otherwise, it's less to the states or to the people. And so we have so many laws, so many agencies on this, but I want to take this, Suzette, into what we call the General Welfare Clause, which is in Article 1, Section 8, in the part that says we can lay taxes for the common defense and the general welfare of our nation. You go back into all kinds of literature, like the Federalist Papers and all that, general welfare meant the general welfare of the nation, not for Suzette, not for Mark, not for General Motors, not for Planned Parenthood or any other organization, the general welfare of the United States. Well, in the Supreme Court actually gave Congress wide discretion. I don't have the year here where this happened. In a case called Halverine versus David, that says general welfare basically is whatever Congress thinks is good for whatever purpose or group. So what that does is it takes Article 1, Section 8, which are the enumerated powers of Congress, and basically makes them mute, because Congress now can pass laws based on this ruling of the General Welfare Clause, which is totally wrong, based on this ruling that says, yeah, whatever Congress thinks is important, oh, we need to put a bridge in over in Phoenix, or we need to build this, or we need to do that, okay?
Oh, the bridges to nowhere? We have this, like, huge debacle in Northern California of a railway system. I don't know how many billions was given to California.
What we're talking about. That's what we're talking about.
Railroad, and there's no track laid. This was an issue when I lived in California 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were arguing about this. California got the money. California spent the money. They bought the land, which, for, of course, they wanted more land. The federal government owns so much of it. Vivek Ravaswamy just brought this up. How much land is owned by the federal government?
Well,
and
there's
you know,
another one. There's another one.
I mean, they're not parks. This is just land. And then, which is wrong. What are they doing with it? And then they can't take care of it. So we end up with these horrible forest fires. And like in Arizona, they actually make an effort to keep the forest clean. Some places you just can't, you know, because it's so mountainous. But, you know, as a general rule, they really do make an effort to practice forestry, since we live in the forest. And that's like very, very helpful. But it's not that way in a lot of states. The land is just left and the government owns it. And
well,
where they
I actually had a logging client up in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
And I travel for about 40 miles, Suzette, through the forest of all, it's a tinderbox. It was just all burnt sticks sticking up in the air. Okay. The government would not allow thinning of the forest. And now I'm with a guy that has a master's degree in forestry. He said, if you thin the forest, the tree next to it can't catch fire if it catches fire. Okay, because there's no kindling in between the trees. And I must have traveled 40 miles into Canada, okay, with him. It was all burnt forest all the way up, okay? And that's all based on the government, okay? The liberals will blame it on climate change. But
and that's the other thing with that. If you're worried about the quality, air quality, for instance, what about these like out of control forest fires, when just, you know, foresting, cultivating, and, you know, thinning those forests would protect the air quality? That's another big
thing. And their logic is, we don't want to kill trees, but you're killing a whole damn forest, you know? And so it's liberal logic. What do you expect? But again, I think that's all by design.
I think it's globalist logic.
It is globalist logic. By the way,
Jefferson was a liberal.
On this charity thing, I'll leave you with a quote on this one. James Madison said, charity is no part of the legislative duty of government. And remember, when the government takes a dollar from Suzette and gives the dollar to Mark because some bureaucrat thought I needed it more than you did, okay, for whatever reason, they own us both.
Yep.
They own us both. And legislators here in Arizona, I saw a sign. It's election season. So-and-so refused this many million dollars from the Department of Education. Okay, it's like, good, right?
Yay.
But that's a negative here, because like, hey, we had funding that we could have used here for our children, right? Little do they know. And when I was running for Congress, I said, we got to get rid of these unconstitutional agencies, starting with the Department of Ed. Okay, they've got like 4,000 people, $60 billion. I don't know what they do all day, okay? But let the education be at the state level. The 10th Amendment says if it's not enumerated in the Constitution, it's left to the states or to the people. There's nothing in the Constitution that says education is part of the deal, okay, with the federal government. So this one woman says to me, I work in education, Mark. Where are we going to get the money from if you get rid of the Department of Education? I go, where do you think they get the money from in the first place? And she looked at me. She goes, oh, I guess from us, huh? I go, yeah. I said, and for every dollar you give them, you might get back 50 cents if you behave. if you do what they say to do. Okay.
Right.
And that's bull.
How did Coke machines and fast food like McDonald's get into schools?
All I'll
That's
tell you
just
is
a disgrace. Look at our
follow the
kids.
money. Follow the money.
Look at our kids. They're like, they're diabetic, overweight, they're lethargic. They have diabetes. They have ADHD. They, you know, they're like, when I was a kid, you know, there were ladies in town that cooked for us. When we lived in the country, we'd be outside playing at recess, and around 10 o'clock, you could smell lunch because there are ladies in there cooking it. And they made sure you ate. Like if your mother packed your lunch or you bought your lunch, there was somebody on patrol and they would stop and say, Susie, does your mom know you're not eating that? Should I call her and ask her to change your fruit? Oh, no, I like that. You know, I mean, you do anything to have like your teacher not call your mother, right? I mean, they really took an interest in us. It wasn't considered overstepping. And you know, you ate your lunch. You know,
well, for the listeners out there today, I just want to let everybody know Suzette just celebrated a birthday. And she was telling me about how she regularly went over to Betsy Ross's house for lunch.
So I used to.
I never saw you there.
Well, you know,
anyway.
I think she, the lady, what was her name? It wasn't Betsy Ross made her flag, but there was a lady who wrote a poem. And it was, shoot off this old gray head if you must, but spare your country's flag. As Sherman, I'm pretty sure it was somebody in the, I should know this. Somebody in the Civil War was marching through our town. I don't think it was Sherman. I don't think he was that far north. We were in Maryland. But she, Barbara Fritchie was her name. She's a star in Frederick, Maryland. Everything was the Barbara Fritchie candy stick restaurant and her house.
Really?
And she stuck her head out the window and said that and wrote a poem about it.
Okay.
And she, you know, so there were people that there have always been people that understood the power of her freedom and the power of their voice, I guess I should say. And today we don't see that so much. And I think part of it, a big part of it, is inflation being where it is. That's people, a lot of people work all the time. And when they do have a chance to listen to something, if they're listening to a radio, they're going to get the propaganda. You know, George Soros just bought 500 conservative radio stations in the U.S. that was fast-tracked through the Federal Trade Commission. I'm pretty sure the FTC has to approve those, but not for George.
Yeah.
You know, the globalist, the Nazi, what do they call that? Sympathizer? Not sympathizer, but he collaborated, Nazi collaborator.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned trade. Let's not forget that Woody Wilson. We did two episodes on Woodrow Wilson, and back in he created the first agency, the Federal Trade Commission, which he had a disdain for the Constitution. He's the father of the progressive movement, and you know he wanted to have more power, and he created the first agency. He created the League of Nations, which led into the UN, which we know about them now, and all that. But the FTC, the trade, so Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress, one of the enumerated powers of Congress, one of the 18 enumerated powers, is to regulate commerce with foreign nations, which means Congress is the one that sets tariffs. Well, not according to, in 1962, the Trade Expansion Act, Section 232, allows the president to implement tariffs without congressional approval. Okay? So here's, again, another infringement on Congress's rights, which you got to remember, Congress, they're us. When I say Congress, I'm talking about you, Suzette, me, my neighbors. They represent us. So by this law, this Trade Expansion Act, allowing the president to set tariffs, they're taking the power away from you and from me. Okay. Now, everybody says, well, what do you think about president? I got asked this by the Club for Growth, David McIntosh, when I went to talk to him about endorsing me. And he said, what do you think about tariffs and President Trump's tariffs with China? I said, well, first of all, I know what he's doing. He's using tariffs to negotiate. Okay. So I really believe President Trump's a free trader. I said, but you know, as much as I either agree or disagree with what he's doing with tariffs, I disagree from a constitutional perspective, because he should not have the right to set a tariff. That should be Congress's job. You know what he said to me? You're the only candidate that came in here and knew that. You're the only one. Okay. And that's scary, because you said you needed a test to run for Congress or whatever. I mean, that's scary that nobody...
You need one to get a driver's license. You need one to become a citizen. Shouldn't the people that are wanting to participate in this constitutional republic understand what their responsibilities are?
They don't. Most people don't know what their job is. So, you know, the tariffs, it's another way. I'm just using this as another example, Suzette, since you brought up the trade issue. Okay. Now, you and I had a very good, we had a little bit of technical difficulties with our connections, but with Paul Gosar on episode 32, we did this whole business about emergency spending. Okay. Article 1, Section 9 says, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. Okay. Well, this emergency spending, now, when the president declares an emergency spending bill, okay, he can circumvent Congress, and Congress can also violate their own rules to spend money, like in Ukraine, like in Gosar told us, and go back to episode 32, we'll get in more detail on this, but Paul Gosar told us that there's still one out there. It's a big one for COVID, okay? There's still one out there for Muammar Gaddafi, and they're still spending money against that. There's 41 of them, and the Cato Institute said since 1990, we have spent $12 trillion on emergency spending. $12 trillion, okay? Congress has the power of the purse, but that's being usurped. Now, again, when I say Congress, I'm talking about everybody who's listening to this podcast. They're taking that right from you, because your representatives no longer have that right. So emergency spending is another. Another one I want to maybe finish on, and it's a minor one, but it's a big one, because you mentioned it. I think it's a big one. You talked about land ownership. And Joe Biden has a 30 by 30 program, meaning that he wants the U.S. government to own 30% of all U.S. land by 2030.
They own more than that now, don't they?
I don't know. I don't think so.
In the western states, they do.
I'm talking about overall. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the 30 by 30, now here's how he's doing it. He did this with the Grand Canyon. He did this with a lot of land here in Arizona and all over the country. There is a, going back to the early 1900s, I forget the year, but there is I'm going brain dead on this right now, but it's the act in which you can declare a site historical for either scientific or historical purposes. Okay. The Antiquity Act. I'm sorry. The Antiquity Act. Okay.
Okay.
It basically gives the president a right when somebody says, hey, this is a historic monument. You can solidify that by saying, like, let's just take an Indian reservation, an ancient Indian reservation. You can preserve that for historical reasons. So it can't be destroyed. You can't build a shopping center on it. You know, that type of thing. Or like we have the meteor crater up here in Arizona. You can't go build a highway over it, because it is now preserved as a with the Antiquities Act. Okay. Now, here's how Biden's using that to grab up land. He's claiming cattle land from cattle farmers. They have less federal, less land now to raise their cattle. And he's using it as a scientific reason. You know what the scientific reason is to claim this cattle grazing land? I'll give you one guess.
Oh, boy.
Kyle Flatulence with global warming. Yes.
What about nuclear war? How do they think that's going to affect global warming?
Don't try to instill logic in, okay? Please.
What a ridiculous, the whole idea.
He's using the Antiquities Act.
They've
okay?
already.
And all the people up in my district when I was running, nobody knew about this, right? They're all big cattle farmers and all that. And the waters of the U.S., the United States, that act as well, trying to claim our water system through the EPA. So all of these things that are going on here is about control. It's about Marxism. And now, if you look at all of these things that we talked about today, and by the way, there's more. Okay, maybe we'll end it here on these items. Take a look at this, and you don't even recognize the Constitution anymore, Suzette.
See, this is what is so crazy, is that when you think of that, like as a citizen, when I think of the government trying to protect the waterways, noble. But that's not what they're talking about. They're not talking about, toxic water coming out of the Corningware factory in Ohio and polluting the Mississippi, mm-hmm. and creating these pockets of these cancer clusters all along it. They're not talking about glyphosate totally contaminating the waterways of the Midwest, including the Mississippi, where you could easily have scrubbers and purifiers. Like they have these ozonators that can clean, take the filthiest water and make it palatable. They're not talking about keeping the waterways clean. They're not talking about respecting our land. They're talking about how can they gain more power by controlling
right.
it.
Right.
And they can afford, they know they can afford the water filter. Flint, Michigan still has foul water.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing they still do. By the way, let's just follow this cattle thing a little bit further, Suzette. Where do you think we'll get our cattle when we can't get it from U.S.? Go ahead, answer the question.
I think that Bill Gates will make it in a Petri dish for us.
we'll get it from our boys from China, who the hell knows what toxins are being infused in that meat when we get it from China. Okay.
That's a pretty good idea. So they found human DNA in the hamburgers at McDonald's in Beijing.
Human DNA?
Human DNA.
Well, at least they're not using monkey brains anymore.
Yeah. Oh, man. I mean,
it's amazing. So,
remind myself of that kind of stuff.
You keep peeling back the onion here, Suzette. When you look at these things here and you say, well, are these all one-off items that I talked about today? Or are they about a collective assault on our freedoms? I got to believe that, because once you understand the overarching goal of the Marxists who are trying to overtake our country, who are trying to kill capitalism in any which way they can, okay, and how they silence you when you try to just stand up for the Constitution. I'm surprised we haven't been X'd off of YouTube so far. Maybe we're not big enough, that's why. But I look at this and I say to myself, this is all of a collective plan. And by the way, I didn't even talk about the Federal Reserve, Suzette. You did two episodes on the Federal Reserve, so I won't repeat that, but how the Marxist agenda is being fueled through the Federal Reserve. So I look at all of these things collectively and say, none of this is by accident. And none of these people are incompetent when they're doing these things. And I can't even look at anybody on our side of the aisle. Either many of the Republicans are useful idiots, or they're part of it. One or the other. I'm sorry, you vote for this kind of crap that I just mentioned, all these different bills and all that. Okay, I'm sorry. There's no excuse for that.
I do call our representatives and our senators' offices. And I always say to them, especially when there's something really heinous, a bill coming up that's really horrible. And I always say to them, don't worry about not getting money. If if it's unconstitutional, please don't vote for it. Vote against it. And if you're threatened with anything, you're not going to get this or you're not going to get that, no big deal. Just tell us. tell us, I would have, you know, the reason we're not getting this is because I wouldn't cast an unconstitutional vote. Just tell the truth.
Well, and you know, it's interesting you said that because, you know, I had people say, well, how are you going to vote when you go to Congress? And I said, look, I'm going to listen to you because you're my constituents.
Yeah.
And I represent you. But if you ask me to do something unconstitutional, I'm going to say no. Okay. And then I will look at the Constitution and also, you know, my Lord, is it the right thing to do? Because you can even say there's some bad things could be constitutional that are just bad to do. Okay.
Right.
Doesn't mean that just because it's constitutional means it's good. It's just that it won't violate the provisions of the Constitution.
And if it's unconstitutional and it's good, you can
don't
propose a constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
You can amend. The Constitution can be amended. It's not written in stone, but it does have checks and balances.
We're going to do an episode on that. Okay. It's called Article 5. And there are pros and cons as to whether or not we open up Article 5. My view on it right now is when you look at the transgressions I just described in this particular episode, I can't trust anybody to open up the Constitution. Look what happened when we did the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment.
Well, okay. There's that. But I'm just saying, like, if you know, there is, the founders considered that.
They did.
And I was just listening to someone who was telling me, oh, we have to get rid of the Constitution because it's so outdated. And I looked at him and I said, well, what about it is outdated? Tell me what
they can't tell you.
Tell me one thing,
right,
that he thought was outdated. Just so I said, did Rachel Maddow tell you that? And then he was like offended. I don't listen to her. And I thought, sound like her. I know. How do I know? I don't listen to her either.
He was parroting. He was parroting what he was told to say, because when I met this college kid one time and she was just singing the left's agenda, I said to her, I said, you know, I don't mean to insult you. I said, but you don't have one original thought in your head. Everything you're telling me, you've been told by your professor. And when I challenge you on it, you have no comeback on it. You have no comeback at what I'm saying, which tells me that you had just been told what to say. And these are all sound bites. They're low resolution, or like you call them, low frequency sound bites. Okay.
Yep.
And you have no fundamental.
They're dangerous. They're very dangerous. Right? Yeah.
And that's something I would tell our listeners, Suzette. I tell our listeners, whenever you get into these discussions, you know, consult the Constitution.
And ask for clarity from the person you're talking
right.
to.
Right.
Why do you think that? Or what about it don't you think is real? Because when you listen to the experts, they will, on the Constitution and the founders, they will tell you that these were learned men. They spoke Latin. They spoke Greek. They read these original documents. You know, I remember, John Adams's son,
right,
saying that he had read the Bible. He was trying to solidify one of the biblical principles. So we went back and he read the Bible in Latin and he read it in Greek.
Show off.
I know. And that is how he was like, this is how he gained his wisdom with this. Now, this is a really brilliant kid because he was nurtured. You know, when his father went to Paris, he ended up becoming like the secretary of some other guy who went to Russia. I mean, he was like 15 years old, 16 years old.
You know what, though, we should do, Suzette? I think on future episodes, some of the things that we should do from time to time is pick one of these founders. I want to start with Jefferson because he's my favorite. Okay. But pick anybody, even Margaret Thatcher. I think she's just off the charts brilliant. But pick some of these founders, and we need to let people know how brilliant these people are. We also need to let them know how they signed a death warrant when they signed the Declaration. Okay. And they would not have met a nice death. It would have been a torturous death. You know, and when they say, oh, they're just a bunch of old men. Really? Yeah. I don't know. Jefferson was, what, 30? When he wrote the
Declaration. They were all young. Okay, they were in their 20s and 30s. I mean, a couple of them. Franklin, I think, was
he was older, yeah. He's another one that I'd love to just dive into and just let people know how brilliant these people were and how they thought and understood the nature of man, how they studied John Locke, they studied how power corrupts, they studied all the different regimes around the world in history. And they didn't have the internet, by the way, Suzanne.
They didn't
Thank
have the
God.
distraction of being propagandized
Right,
from
right.
morning to night on all of these other shiny objects that dilute your focus and intention. That would sit down and really like work on these things and have and discuss these things. This is where the tutoring system of being tutored by someone as opposed to going into a class with 40 other people and everybody getting treated equally. When you're being tutored, your tutor can challenge you. Your tutor, you know, a teacher can't always do that in a classroom because they have those a wide variety of intellects sitting in there. Does that make sense?
You know, IQ is not even talked about. I know we're going a little bit off track here, but IQ is not even discussed when it comes to education. And I'm sorry, to teaching somebody with a 95 IQ and another kid with 130 IQ, you just that's not set up for success. Okay, it's not.
I was just talking to one of my moms. I used to work in autism, and many years ago, and like 1997 to 2010. So, and I met a lot of amazing parents. So I know the story. And I was talking to one of my moms and she said to have, there are so many autistic kids now, some like one in 33 boys has autism. And they have them mainstreamed in school and it just doesn't work anymore.
It's nuts. It's nuts.
Because they're disruptive. Like, how do you tell one kid you have to sit here and pay attention and the other kid is screaming in the back?
Well, I'll tell you another thing. My wife taught high school, and here's how. So when a kid would take one of her tests that was in special education, here's how the test had to be administered by a special ed teacher. So if it was a multiple choice test, let's say there's a question that says, what is the capital of the United States? And this is how the teacher would present the question. Okay, Johnny, what's the capital of the United States? A, New York. B, Los Angeles. C, Washington, D.C. And D, Cleveland, Ohio. Okay? And everybody gets an A, and everybody moves on. And that's how they taught special ed in this high school that she was in. So I don't know what to tell you. Well, we're getting off track, but I guess this goes back to, I guess, the education that you said we all need to have in order to even put your hat in the ring.
I'm definitely going to be listening to the Hillsdale EDU Constitution 101
They're
class. And I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Well,
also,
stop plugging them. They got to listen to us first. I think Hillsdale can learn from us.
Oh gosh, wouldn't that be something?
So, Suzette, final word. You got any final words on this? I mean, I'm just trying to paint a picture here as to how we are legislating ourselves out of existence when it comes to this thing we call America, this experiment we call America.
I would ask everybody to get a little uncomfortable. It's okay. When you start understanding some of this stuff, it's difficult. Mm-hmm. It is difficult because you realize that a lot of the things that you have been listening to are all based in confirmation bias. We tend to only listen to the things that confirm what we believe. And what we believe has in most cases been indoctrinated by repetition, hearing it. You live in a democracy. How many times have you heard somebody say you live in a constitutional republic? You know,
Are they ever?
Hear this stuff and you keep saying, well, this is a democracy. The last thing on earth you want is a democracy, people, because if you're a minority, you'll never be heard. That was why we don't have a democracy. You know, it's majority rule. You always want the majority to get their way. What happens to the minority? You know, so there's a lot of there. This is what the founders grappled with. And so that would be my.
They were brilliant. That was brilliant. And you know, I want to go back to episode 7. We talked about republic versus democracy. And if anybody ever wants an elevator speech as to the difference, a democracy, which is mob rule, and I think Franklin said this, is, I may get this numbers wrong, is three wolves and one lamb deciding what to have for lunch.
Yep.
A republic is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're a republic, not a democracy. It drives me nuts when I hear people say that. I see it on TV all the time. Our debates set and democracy in action. It's like, no, we're not a democracy. And I gotta believe, Suzette, that is by design. I'm sorry.
Of course it is.
I'm a conspiracy theorist, okay? I admit it.
They're sitting there in this last VP debate. And with President Trump, when President Trump went into that, he goes, yeah, it's going to be three against one because they're fact checking him.
Yeah.
But Kamala, who is like lost in space, you know, she never gets fact checked.
Yeah, but you know that she was a poor child. She grew up in.
She was in this interview. She says to the guy, I've never been to what he said. Have you been to the border? And she doesn't answer. She goes yapping about something else. He goes, well, have you been to the border? She goes, why do you keep bringing that up? Have I been to Europe? No. Well, actually, she had been to Europe.
Well, I was going to say, if you're the vice president of the United States and you haven't been to Europe, that's a big deal. I'm sorry.
I mean, what have you been doing? I mean, part of her job as a VP is to stand in and represent our country and stand in for the president when he can't go. Well, we have a disabled president. He's very ill. He has been for years. Where's she been? And people want to elect her. I mean, that's a crazy.
Oh, come on. Suzette, you're just a sex. You're sexist. That's you're a sexist, right wing. Not that's what you are. Okay?
Everything my judgment is totally rooted in merit. If somebody, I don't care who they are, what language they speak, how short, fat, tall, thin, what the color of their skin is, if they have merit in their argument, I'm all in. I'm
I'm
listening.
Just glad you didn't mention hair. Okay.
But you know what I mean? This identity politics is just another Marx.
No, it's a joke. It's a joke.
It's
so that, this was okay. called this was called
checks and balances.
The checks and balances are unchecked and unbalanced. And this was episode 34. Thank you for your input on this. And I think we got to start working on the different founders and start doing a little bio and let people know how incredibly brilliant these people were.
Let's start with Thomas Jefferson. I think that's a good idea. And I want to address the inconsistencies between what he wrote and what he did and why that was. I think that's a very important topic. And
I'll tell you another thing that people say about Jefferson. We'll talk more about this, of course, in a future episode, but they say he didn't believe in God. No, he was a deist. That doesn't mean you don't believe in God. Okay. And so many misconceptions about him, you know? And anyway, okay. I'll tell you what, let's end it here.
Okay.
Nice job. Thanks for your input. Suzette,
thank you.
Episode 34, you know, in the previous episode, he had a nice red dress or shirt on and that was so bright. And now on this one, you have a black one on. And I think that's very appropriate for this episode because this is almost like a dark cloud on our nation with all these transgressions
yes,
that are going on. So,
yes,
but thanks, Suzette. We'll talk to you next time. Again, this was episode 34. And check out some of those previous episodes that we referenced because there's a lot of good detail there that will help make this maybe make a little bit more sense. See you guys next time.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks,
bye,
Suzette.
Everyone. Thanks for listening. And
bye-bye.
Be sure to comment. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Constitution Solution, one podcast under God, where we hold that strict adherence to the Constitution is the solution to most of our country's problems.
You can find other episodes on our website at 1787solution.com, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and most other platforms. We're your hosts, Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence. Until next time, may God bless you and may God bless America.